Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from a most beautiful day in Fort Worth, Texas. We've been visited by some of the wonderful natural things here lately, which has been awesome. We had two Mississippi kites mating in our post oak trees yesterday. That was cool. And a green knoll was puffing out its red throat sac at us through the window, and that's pretty magical. So the magic and generosity of the universe is all around us, and that's not just for me, but for all of us, and all we have to do is look. So that's part of the wonder of creation. Today I welcome a prolific author, Will Johnson, to the show. He's written such books as Breathing Through the Whole Body, The Spiritual Practice of Rumi, and Eyes Wide Open. He's also the director of the Institute for Embodiment Training, a teaching school in Costa Rica. Today we'll be looking at his latest book. It's entitled Cannabis in Spiritual Practice, The Ecstasy of Shiva and the Calm of Buddha. All right, so it's a pleasure to welcome Will Johnson to today's show. Glad you're with us.
Glad to be here. As just an opening remark, I really appreciated your acknowledging the birds in nature. Mm-hmm. Where you live, because that's so much of what this is all about, is opening to one's nature.
Absolutely. You know, and the key word for you there is embodiment, isn't it? You know, this is happening in our body. We'll talk about that. That we say in Unity, the longest journey is from our head to our heart. You know, even though it's only 12 inches, it's a huge, long journey for us to get out of our heads. And I know you talk about that a lot in the book. Before we get to that, though, I want to say, first off, it is about cannabis, folks, if you're listening to this show. But if you're not really into that, if you're not into mind-altering substances, it's still a good book, because it's a spiritual guidebook focusing on the core practices of the Buddha and introducing to some of us some of the body-rich techniques of Shaivism, followers of Shiva. It's a guide, as we said, to embodied living, right? Activating the deep intelligence of the body. So often we think our intelligence is simply intellectual or in our heads. Sometimes we talk about intuition, but it's a sort of a vague thing. This is much more embodied, in the sense that it's real. It's part of our connection to the earth, which is, you know, vibrantly important. So, you know, if you want to talk about some of the aspects of cannabis in the book, it's there, but it's definitely not something that you have to buy into, right? You couch your language around it very, very much in that way. You know, you say you can use cannabis if you like, but you don't have to, right?
Yeah, you know, very much so. Now, as a teacher within the Buddhist world, I don't promote cannabis as something to bring into your practices, but I'm not loath to deny the people that use cannabis, that it helps them, that they feel it supports their spiritual journey from doing that either. And really what I attempted to do with this book, the first section as you were alluding to, is to explain why traditional Buddhist practices don't particularly work all that well. Cannabis, but if you move over into the whole world, not of the Buddha, but of Shiva, cannabis can almost, for many people, be considered an integral component of the practice.
Right. Yeah. And of course, we're at this stage, especially in America, you know, where this is open for debate, isn't it? You know, cannabis is becoming legalized in some states. You know, CBD oil is legal in some states, etc. So that there's been a decriminalizing of the whole use of the drug, I think, over the years, because there's always a backlash. You know, whenever there's a liberalizing, there's the retrenching, isn't there, of some folks, you know, and the reefer madness kind of people come out and say, you know, it's going to kill us all or whatnot. It's a gateway drug, and you know, the whole story like that. But, you know, there seems to be a common understanding that it seems to have much more benefit than it does harm, right? That's the considered opinion, it seems.
Yeah, you know, very much so for the majority of people. Now, the reality also is that cannabis doesn't work for some people,
right.
But it works for many, many, many people. And to prohibit a substance just because it doesn't work for a small percentage of our population, from my perspective, isn't the optimum way to go. What I stress in this book, everybody needs to take responsibility and make the decisions that are appropriate for them. For many of the students that I've worked with in the Buddhist world who actually do include cannabis within their practices, I support them and I encourage them to keep exploring it and to, keep in mind that if you're going to use cannabis, which is very potent for your spiritual practices, be even more mindful of what you're actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
So really, to me, it comes down to ultimately taking responsibility for our own choices. We have everything we need inside of us. Our nature is inside of us from the head to the heart, as you were saying. It's right there, but it has lain dormant for too long. We haven't felt it. And that's where the whole notion of embodiment comes from as well.
Right. Yep. And, you know, we mentioned it earlier, moving out of our heads. You talk about the Buddha's journey, right? That he had everything he could be given, all the pleasures of the world, but it didn't satisfy him. And there was this inherent yearning to find out more, right? And, of course, the three sights of sickness, old age, and death, you know, that he saw shook him out of his trance, right? And then he went to the other extreme, into the jungle, into the forest, and emaciated himself, and then finally came to the middle way, right? The middle way between indulgence and abstinence, which was the way that led to his awakening, right? To his enlightenment. And you call it the calm, the calm nature of the Buddha. And I'm not sure I like that particularly, in the sense is that what he was, a calm dude, a mellow man? He was, but there was still fire in him, wasn't there?
Oh yeah, well, I don't know, not as much fire as in someone like Jesus. But having said that, I kind of like what you're getting at. Because in some ways, one of my observations about the Buddhist world, and it's a wonderful world filled with the most hard-hearted people that you can imagine, it tends to be a little bit stiff, a little bit frozen, and a little bit tight.
Right.
And the teaching that I'm actually doing within the Buddhist world by bringing embodiment back into the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings, is in a sense, you could say, a way to, literally fire us up, to become more alive, become more vital, to actually feel what it is to be alive in this moment, getting out of the head with its concepts of what it is to be human being living on the planet this time.
Right, yeah. And, I can accept that. I think people are drawn to Tibetan Buddhism for that reason, because it seems to be more juicy and, there's more opportunities for the fire in the belly kind of thing, involved in that Tibetan Buddhist practice. And somebody like Pema Chodron, comes from that tradition, very much gives flavor, and real world examples, right? Rather than it be a little too cerebral. So I do like that embodying of, in fact, somebody sent me a book the other day by a chap named Ian Ian Baker, I think it is. He's a well-known Buddhist scholar, and anyway, he's got a new book out called Tibetan Yoga. So I'm looking forward to reading that and having him on the show. Gorgeous! It's full of glossy photos, you know, from the Tibetan traditions. Very, very good stuff. You got a chapter that I love the title of the chapter. It's passing through the barrier of the egoic. What is it? What's the last word? Fiction, right? Sorry, my handwriting is so bad. It's fiction. Passing through the barrier of the egoic fiction. I love it.
Okay, well, let's talk.
Tell me about it.
Okay, well, you know, look, the quality of consciousness that passes as normal in the world at large is a very disembodied consciousness,
right,
where we are identified with the speaker of our thoughts. We all have the same name for that person. We call that speaker I. That's the perspective. And, you know, there's nothing necessarily false about that, but it's very, very limiting, and it's limited. And what's going on with that, when you are lodged in the thoughts, you know, the random unbidden thoughts in your head, you are literally out of touch with the felt presence of the body. So what I'm getting at here is that on every part of the body, down to the smallest cell, and if those of your listeners who are tuning in, they're not driving a car, but they're, you know, at home, hold out a palm with your palm facing up. And in a short period of time, if you put your attention into your hand, you're going to start feeling this vibratory buzzing, tingling, humming. Now, it's there, and it's there in every part of the body. But when we're so lost in our heads, identified with the speaker of those thoughts, we have to block the whole world of this embodied presence. Now, what to me is fictive about the egoic perspective is that it believes that it's the only game in town, the only perspective on consciousness that is legitimate. And what those of us who actually open to the felt presence of the body, really, you know, really let go through the body, bringing sensations to awareness, letting go, you know, with the medium of breath through some of the holdings, the unnecessary holdings and tensions. You know, what we find is that there is an alternative dimension of consciousness, a far more embodied consciousness that exposes the egoic perspective belief that it's the only game in town as as a fiction. I actually feel fine with egoic limitation. I'm not like some of the spiritual practitioners say in India that view this world as just an illusion. Yes, it may be mirage-like, but it's also a level of reality. And ego is a level of reality. It's just not the ultimate one. If we want to, a couple of things. We want to gain some kind of spiritual evolution and growth. But even beyond that, Paul, if we just want to start feeling good as a human being within our body, within what passes or what we conventionally call the mind.
Right. And you talk about the Heart Sutra in that regard, which I like, you know, the idea that it talks about form and emptiness, right? Not that you've got to jettison one in order for you to have the other, but they're both aspects of the dance, if you like. So you can have an ego and be a spiritual being at the same time, right?
Absolutely. And I actually, believe, or my experience has been with something like the Heart Sutra, one of the most revered texts in the whole of Buddhism, saying that reality as we perceive it, obviously including ourselves, partakes of two forms, the physical, solid form, but then this underlying emptiness. Now, to me, it is not one or the other. The egoic perspective will be lodged in the world of form, in which everything is separate from everything else. The embodied perspective also experiences this vast, open, feelingful space that pervades everything and ties all the apparently separate pieces back into a unified whole. So what I want people to do is experience both simultaneously, not one or the other.
Right. You know, the Isha Upanishad, you know, from India, mentions this. It says, you know, into great darkness go those who only believe in the immanent nature of spirit, right? But even greater darkness are those that fall into the idea of it's a transcendent nature of the divine. And, you know, and it's pointing out that it's you have to have both. It's an integration of the two. Otherwise, you're in, you know, you're lost in transcendence, or you're lost in immanence. And we have this struggle in unity right now, because some folks are trying to get away from the idea of praying to God, you know, because, well, God's within you, so you don't need to pray to this outside God. But that can be a problematic thing, because then you begin to think, well, I don't need, you know, the mystery. I don't need the emptiness. I got it all within myself. I got God in my pocket. So, you know, there's a definite balance there, I think, that we have to. The key, though, is the last statement, isn't it? Is the great mantra at the end of the Heart Sutra, which you translate in the Osho version, right? What is it? Gone beyond, gone completely beyond. You know, what an awakening, you know, hallelujah, whatever. So that means for me that it's beyond both, right? It's both are constructs that have to go, right? I can rest in them, I can enjoy them as the dance, but ultimately the dance is beyond even anything I can imagine the universe to be, you know, the implicate or the explicate order, as Niels Bohm says. You know, it's a mystery, right? It can only be, as you mentioned in the book, nobody can tell you this. You have to discover it for yourself, right?
Yeah, and it's
this
really
freedom.
And there is freedom, and it's free to everybody. And you know, once again, it's not just form, it's not just emptiness. You know, you're talking about the conversations about God within your church. Is God something only outside? Is God something only inside? Why isn't it, you know, both and you know, everything more? Mostly what we get is people living totally within the one dimension of the world of form. Or you get people that are into transcendent forms of spirituality.
Right.
That on this world is illusion, something that only a spiritual lowlife would be interested in. I don't buy that. I don't think that's how it works, because you can get every bit as locked inside yourself as you can get locked outside yourself.
Right.
So, you know, the open dimension that I speak of, I call it the Great Wide Open. It's really, you know, an amalgamation of felt experience of everything that you are, opening to everything that you can perceive and experience in your senses at this moment. And it's
right.
A nice place. It's the bottom line. It's a wonderful, wonderful experiential dimension to rest in.
When I was growing up in the 60s and you know, experiencing spirituality for the first time, it was always this idea that, you know, you've got to become enlightened. And there were certain people who were enlightened, right? And you were trying to, you know, emulate them, whatever that was, this state of enlightenment. And, you know, I've given that one up years ago because it's such an illusion, right? It's presupposing that you can perfect your egoic nature to such a degree that it could become enlightened, you know? Well, it's what it is. It's just what it is. And you are already wide open, right? You have it within you as the fish in the ocean, you know, has the water all around it. It's part of our nature. So it's just it's about relaxing, isn't it? Relaxing and it's the relief of letting go, of having to work it all out, basically, right?
Just and I couldn't agree with you more. You know, Paul, for me, everything is about awakening the body and relaxing. There is an 11th century text that's very important to me from a Indian-born Tibetan teacher, Tilopa, the Song of Mahamudra. He gives the whole of meditation instructions in one pithy sentence, and he says, do nothing with the body but relax. That's it. Just keep relaxing and just experience what starts happening when relaxation replaces the tension that ordinarily fills our bodies. Hey, look, for us to be lost in thought, we have to bring tension into our body. So we're wanting to relax and experience the kind of transformation that occurs when that happens.
Right, yep. And it's right here under our noses.
Right under our noses.
We have a hard time finding it sometimes.
Yeah. Looking for love in all the wrong places.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the precepts, you know, the basic five precepts of the Buddhist path, and of course there's many more, there's 10, there's hundreds of them, but the five that we often talk about, you know, very elegant, and they imitate, don't they, or they're comparable with some of the 10 commandments, right? Yeah. They're pretty much the same. They're beautifully elegant ways of living our lives. And you talk about them in an earlier chapter, and then you revisit them at the end of the book where you, you know, frame them in another way. And what I love about the precepts is you can take them at all levels, right? What, one is, you know, don't kill other people. Well, right. you know, be harmless, which you could take literally, don't harm another person, but it's also don't kill them by hateful thoughts, right? So we can be killing people all the time by character assassinating someone or whatever, or even killing ourselves because we feel we're worthless or whatnot. So it's the levels we take these precepts at that give us such rich understanding, right? I think in the end of the book, you know, in terms of don't kill, you frame it as honor life, right? So you're using it in a more positive sense rather than don't do something. You know, you're saying, well, bring an honoring attitude, right, to everything that we do. It's everything is sacred. In other words, there's value in everything, even the worst things that happen to us, right? So we can honor that.
You know, right. And, you know, what I did is that I took the precepts that are couched in negative language, don't do this, don't do that.
Right.
And in a sense, translated them. What would those precepts look like if we spoke positively? So honoring life is, as you're saying, honoring nature, honoring life, but also honoring the aliveness in yourself. Remember what mm-hmm. we just said? You're lost in thought. It's like a teeter-totter. You're lost in thought. That's elevated. There is no awareness of body. You've kind of squelched the vitality, mm-hmm. the lived experience of this vibratory splendor that's here. So honoring life is starting right at home. But, you know, awakening the body, wake it back up, bring it out of its slumber, bring it alive, honor it. Then the other steps follow suit.
One thing I've got to mention, folks, is that part of the book are sort of guided meditations that you could follow. They're beautiful. And there's also audio tapes, right? I think you've got the ability for people to get to hear it in that way as well. So these are very practical. They lead you through various meditations. Some of them are around this awakening of the body. And sort of a yoga postures. Some of them are the dance, right? You lead us through the dance of Shiva. And then there's even the dance of sex, where you can use these beautiful words with your partner to have a more felt experience. And I like the gazing one, too. There's one where you gaze at each other, right? And look at each other beyond all the the personas that we present, right? The real person in there. And that can be quite unnerving, can't it? Because you're used to approaching each other through those layers, right? So to peel the layers away and see the real person can bring us to tears. I think it's so powerful, you know?
Powerful, and it is one of the practices that cannabis can strongly support. What does cannabis do? It wakes the unfelt body up. You know, people will inhale or eat or something, then they often say they're fuzzing. Well, that's the sensations of the body waking themselves up. Now, the gazing practice is an extraordinarily potent practice for waking the unfelt body up, and it challenges, forces, and gives to people an opportunity to melt away those kinds of personas, those barriers that literally physically exist between us. The gazing practice is so simple. You sit down with a friend, whether you use cannabis or not, you just start gazing at each other. Often your gaze will gravitate towards the person's left eye, and then you just relax and all sorts of things just start happening on their own. You're going to start experiencing the felt presence of your body much more strongly than you ordinarily do. The visual field can start getting very, very unusual, almost hallucinatory. And that happens with cannabis or not. You know, outlines can fade. You can see, light around the person. They might even, their face might transform into something else. And the nature of that practice, you just surrender. You go along for the ride. There's nothing you need to stop from happening. There's nothing you need to make happen. And, you know, honestly, Paul, I look back on my life, and of all the practices that I've been fortunate enough to stumble upon, the gazing practice is clearly the most potent, that takes people rapidly through. The fiction of the egoic perspective gets revealed very, very rapidly, and we experientially start moving into these great wide open states that are so fundamental, to us as incarnate spiritual beings.
Right. Yeah, I'm a granddad for the fourth time, and have two little ones, real small. We love, I think not me, human beings love to look at babies, right? Of course, we're wired with the cuteness of them, but I think there's also, we're gazing into the infinite when you're looking into a baby's eyes, into their face, because they're undifferentiated, right? They haven't entered this world of the head yet. And so you're really looking into your own soul in a way, right? Which is quite a profound experience. And it's full of wonder, because you wonder what is going on for that child, or what are they seeing? You know, because sometimes they'll fix their gaze on you and you think, oh my goodness, I'm being looked at by, in a very unnerving way by this tiny little new life. So it's the same idea, I think, that connectedness.
Yeah. And it's only unnerving in that it's initially unusual.
Right.
And usually what happens when people first sit down and enter into the gazing practice, well, the felt experience of the body comes up so dramatically, far more dramatically than we're accustomed to experience, that, whoa, that gets a bit unnerving. And should I look away? Should I shut it down? Just keep relaxing into what initially strikes you as unnerving. You break through that initial awkward.
We are spiritual beings having a human experience. Welcome to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio. This programming is made possible through the generous donations of listeners like you. If you feel inspired by this programming, we invite you to contribute. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate to make your offering today. Thank you for your support. Here is a Unity Meditation Minute with Paulette Pipe.
So as always, we begin our time of meditation by first taking account of what we're feeling, those sights that we're seeing, those sensations that we're experiencing, and each breath that we breathe. Notice where in your body you're experiencing those sensations. Let your breathing find its own rhythm as we begin the process of letting go, the process of relaxation. Remember why we're here.
To hear more from Paulette Pipe and Touching the Stillness, visit the archives section at unityonlineradio.org.
Know yourself as divine. Stations of the Cosmic Christ, a new book from Matthew Fox and Bishop Mark Andrus, introduce a spiritual practice designed to help you realize the divine within. Combining prayer and an interpretation of the Stations of the Cross, featuring beautiful imagery, you will be led on a process of transformation. This book will help you discover the most caring, courageous, and compassionate parts of yourself. Get your copy today at Amazon.com or unity.org/shop.
Ah, Italy. The food, the wine, the art, the culture. Join friends from Unity on a trip to Italy in the spring of 2020. In Rome, you'll walk in the footsteps of the Apostle Paul, visit the Colosseum and the Roman Forum, then head down the beautiful Amalfi Coast to Sorrento, the Isle of Capri, and the ruins of Pompeii, all with people you feel as if you already know. For more, visit unity.org/travel.
Recovery from addiction can be a lonely experience. Get help and support with Reverend Lonnie Vanderslice, Reverend Dan Beckett, and Spirit of Recovery every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Central. Welcome to a place where spirituality and recovery meet. Each week, you'll hear stories and topics that are important to the recovery community. Tune in for some lively conversation and join in with your questions and comments. Nearly 21 million people struggle with addiction in America. Reach out and join us here on unityonlineradio.org.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Will Johnson. He's a well-known author. He's the director of the Center or the Institute for Embodiment Training in Costa Rica. Has written a number of books on spiritual practices, especially embodiment practices, coming down into the felt experience of our bodies and not just hanging out in our heads. And his latest book is called Cannabis and Spiritual Practice, The Ecstasy of Shiva and the Calm of Buddha. So let's talk about the ecstasy of Shiva. You know, for some of us are familiar with who Shiva is and some not, but he's one of the great gods of the Hindu tradition, right? There's traditionally three: the creator god, the preserver god, you know, Brahma, Vishnu, and then the destroyer god. But it's not really a destroyer god, it's more the transformational god, yeah. If you like, you know, it shifts everything. Right. And and Shiva's interesting because, you know, in some traditions he's an ascetic, you know, sits in meditation for thousands of years, and in other traditions he's libidinous and is having endless sex parties, so he's a bit of both, I guess. You know, he's the man of the mountains, but he's also you know, the man of ecstasy and passion. Yeah. So this is us, though, isn't it? This is the human being, if you like. We are both. We're form and emptiness. Yeah. You can't have one, the one without the other.
Right. Now, the legends down to this day about Shiva, my sense is that Shiva was a real person upon whom a lot of mythic dazzle would get. That he was a very, very real person. And the legends down to this day talk about how Shiva and his wife Parvati, they lived around Mount Kailas in Tibet, a very sacred place, and that they would make up a bong mixture, a cannabis drink. Shiva would drink the mixture, and the legends down to this day say that what would happen to him, his body would come alive and start making spontaneous movements. Mm. And these spontaneous movements, this is how he brought the body-oriented practices of hatha yoga and dance to the planet. Now this story is so fascinating because that's certainly what happened to me as a young man when I first started using cannabis and then started exploring the felt experience of my body. My body started waking up, and I remember a specific day down in a garden in a late afternoon, and I had had a bit of cannabis. I went down. It was a beautiful day, and all of a sudden, my body just exploded in sensation, and it started moving. An arm started moving, another arm, and, you know, I was interested enough in this kind of thing to go, well, this is interesting, and it was surrender. I was not doing these motions. They were, they were all spontaneous. And that went on for about a half an hour. At one point, I thought, well, maybe I better, see if I can stop this. I was a young guy out in the woods in the early 1970s, before you had a yoga center and dance therapy on every corner of every major city. And I said, I hope this is bringing me more sanity. And I stopped it. So great. I saw I could stop this, bring it to a stop. It felt so awful to return back to normal. At that point, hey, here goes nothing. And I let go. And I've really explored that. I call it my dance all through my life. And I've actually brought that quality of motility and spontaneous motion into the Buddhist world because, you know, again, these very good-hearted Buddhists, when they sit in meditation, are a bit stiff, a bit frozen, a bit still. And it's we can just start surrendering to the body, surrendering to the breath, and a lot of this motion comes back into our practices. Now, my wife did her yoga teacher training in India, in Benares, probably 40 years ago. And it consisted of two parts. One was four weeks every day, 5 hours a day with her teacher. And then he told her to go into the Himalayas for 4 months and go into retreat and do the practices all day. Now, this was an area where there were a lot of wandering Shiva Babas or sadhus. Mm-hmm. And occasionally she'd wake up in the morning and there were these very interesting men, mostly men, who'd shown up and taken shelter in her porch. And they were always very respectful and gracious towards her and would invite her to join in their practices with her. And as followers of Shiva, before they would start doing their body practices, their hatha yoga practices, their breathing practices, their moving practices, they would invoke Shiva by lighting up a chillum. It's a kind of pipe with cannabis in it, because that is the sacrament that would tune them into the energy of Shiva and would allow their practices to just spontaneously start happening. So that was a very fascinating experience for her, and it was fascinating for me to meet her. And at this point, while I've met so many, well, probably mostly younger people that I share this story with, and they say, yeah, that sounds about right. You know, the whole world of spontaneous movement and dance, it's erupted around the planet. And that's what Shiva was about. It was about, in a sense, awakening the body, totally awakening the body, awakening the energies of the body, and then realizing that those awakened energies form a kind of organic current with a directional pulse. Well, let's just surrender to that current and see what happens. And that current is a spiritually and physically healing and emotionally healing current that if we could just get out of our own way, we resist it, we block it. It's unnerving to many of us, accustomed as we are to the quality of consciousness that passes as normal, lost in thought. But when we can just start letting go to that, all sorts of wonderful, spontaneous healing events start occurring. Deep tensions come to the surface and they let go. Different emotional states come to the surface and they let go. Now, for me, that happens within the Buddhist world without cannabis. But it happens very, very poorly for me when I embrace cannabis as a spiritual sacrament in this context.
Right. Yeah. And I've come across the babas, you know, the sadhus or whatever, a few times in my life, and there's some even more radical ones, you know, the naga babas that things that would not be acceptable, right? If you're a Brahmin priest or whatever, you have to have a strict protocol of what's right and what's wrong. These kick the traces completely. And I mean, they're sitting in graveyards, they're eating dead flesh, you know, they're eating feces as well. They do the most, the things that everybody would think were the most horrendous things, right? And I think they're doing it to show that, again, like everything, you know, these are just constructs. Ultimately we're free, right? And they don't encourage everybody to live like that, But there is a sort of radicalism to the Shivites of that they're not all Shivites are that way inclined, but there's definitely a goodly amount in India, because sometimes they have these festivals and, you know, thousands of these sadhus will show up, right? And they're usually covered in ash, and they've got Rudraksha beads and, you know, orange robes and long beards or whatever, and look kind of wild, actually. They're out there, right? They're weirder than any freak or hippie of the you know, 60s and 70s.
Very true. You know the Naga Babas, I think they're out there just to blow our minds, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Outrageous things, and it reminds me of a well-known poem by the 13th century Sufi poet and mystic Rumi, where he says that out beyond all of our ideas, any ideas you might have of what's right and what's wrong, go way out past those ideas. There's a field out there. That's where I can meet you. And that's where, you know, the interesting, you know, releases and surrenders and, you know, letting go and letting God can start happening. Now, the Shiva Babas, my understanding is that they follow very ethical precepts, but they also definitely acknowledge cannabis as the sacrament of their spiritual practice. It worked for Shiva. You know, if you want to know what Shiva did, you have to do what Shiva did. Mm-hmm. And she would drink the bhang mixture, and then these practices would start. So the Shiva Babas are certainly many of the ones that my wife, Coco, ran into, as she lived in India. They viewed cannabis as a very sacred substance, a spiritual sacrament, not just something to get high and hang out with. Although I don't know people doing that either. You know, it's a teaching tool. We have to make of it at whatever level we're open to being open to it.
Right. Yep. Well, I've had a few chillums in my life, and they usually scour my my throat, because you're very close to those coals there with the cannabis is resting on. You have to put a damp cloth at the bottom of the chillum, you know, so you don't just go up in flames. But
it's very old technology right now.
Old technology. Yeah, definitely not vaping. Yeah.
Yeah, the technology of THC ingestion has evolved.
Yeah, well, so is the potency of THC, it seems, over the years. You know, it's nothing like it was back in the day. But, you know, this program is not advocating the use of any illicit substance, folks. If you want to do it, that's fine. I think there's the purely legal substance of alcohol is way worse in some regards. It certainly results in greater amounts of death than any use of cannabis. So, that's totally legal, right? So there we go. Yeah. That's another way of moving beyond the egoic mind and what we accept as reasonable, whereas other things aren't. You know, it's kind of insane a little bit.
Everybody has to make these choices for themselves. I want people to take responsibility, to acknowledge that in the jurisdiction you're living in, you may be violating, the law. But still, people have to make these judgments for themselves. Is this something that feeds my soul? Then I'm going to take it into my body. If is this something that doesn't work for me, then I won't use it. It's as simple as that. And I know that still there is a substantial part of Western society that probably doesn't like my saying that. But I just want people to get in touch with what's real for themselves, take responsibility for that. Shed the beliefs, shed secondhand beliefs, and let's opening into firsthand, direct, embodied experience.
Right.
Yeah. I don't care if you do it.
You don't care what? Sorry.
I don't care how people do that. If people, if cannabis or things like ayahuasca or, you know, in our time, I mean, I sense you and I are the same vintage LSD, done in a sacred way. To me, it was very clear that you do a substance like LSD, You go out into beautiful nature on a beautiful day where you're not going to be, come across other people, and you open huge. There's an illegal substance that a lot of young people use for raves. I don't know. They get up and dance because what my partner Coco and I enjoy doing, maybe once a year, is to take something like that. And then we sit at opposite ends of we'll be out in nature for a while, and then we feel the effects. We go inside, we sit at opposite ends of a sofa, maybe for the next 6 hours, doing the gazing practice. And that's something that needs to be experienced, to be believed. It's that wonderful. We'll do a lot of yoga, as preparation for a ceremony like that. But really, it's up to all of us as individuals. What do we want for ourselves? We're only here for a very, very short time. The older we get, we realize how short it is.
Absolutely.
A short time. How do I want to use my time? There is something knocking at my door. Some of us hear that knock more than others, but there's something knocking at my door. Am I going to go and open that door and open to everything that comes rushing through, and honoring it and accepting it? Or am I going to keep locking the door, keeping it shut, and staying locked in my mind, in my thoughts, identifying with the speaker of the thoughts, and accepting impossible to verify beliefs over directly to be felt sensations?
And that brings us back to the five precepts, which is, as long as we're not doing it to harm others, or to diminish ourselves, then those are the wise gatekeepers, right? These practices are fine as long as we're not endangering ourselves or other people in doing this. So I think that's wise. Of course, the Buddha said, don't take any substances that can intoxicate the mind, and you could literally say, well, you shouldn't be using drugs, but it's also the intentional use of things. I think the Buddha was very much into what's your awareness that you bring to this, right? So if you're doing things just to zone out, to go back into the trance, that's right. What he's referring to, I think. But if you're using substances in very intentionally to experience something of an opening, then and you're using it wisely in that regard, skillfully, then I think that's way different, right, than the heedlessness.
And I feel very strongly about how you've just put that. You know, when I reformulated the precepts from don't do this, don't do that,
right,
into honor life, speak the truth, only put into your body what feeds your body and soul. Now, the Buddhist precept says no intoxicating substances. Now, I and so many other people have found that substances like cannabis support my spiritual awakening when I use it in the context of very intentional practices. So for a Shaivite not to use something like this would, in a sense, almost be unethical. Again, you just want to be very, very clear. Does this work for you? Are you using it consciously, intentionally, wisely? Are you getting closer to the big opening, or are you just using it to, avoid again? One thing that I have noticed about the contemporary spiritual world, at virtually every retreat that I've ever taught, I get invited into the Buddhist world because the Buddhists, these wonderful peoples, realize that they probably have gotten a little stiff and tight in their practices. And someone like me, they welcome into their world, even though I'm somewhat of an outlier in that world, but I love sitting meditation, right? But I'm able to come in and get people to open their breath, to relax, that the body comes out of its frozen, out of its frozen mold. I get, invited in for that reason, but I do view the current spiritual world's attitude towards something like cannabis, can't use it, very bad, not good, stay away from that, honestly, Paul, not a heck of a lot different from how we can look back, say, in the 1950s and you know, the cultural straight world's attitude towards gays. It was shaming, blaming, ostracism. It's very bad. Well, we've evolved out of that in many parts of our world. Love is a wonderful thing, and miracle whenever it happens between whomever it happens to. And I do feel that maybe we're at a tipping point where some of the very rigid negativity, it's not only from the straight cultural world, but from the traditional spiritual world towards a substance like cannabis, can start evolving as well. Now, we want this to work for us, so we have to do practices.
Right, yep. You know, I thought it was the Episcopalians that were known as God's frozen chosen or whatever, but you're saying that the the Buddhist little, you know, they do have walking meditation. Now come on, they get up out of their seat sometimes and walk around, but again, it's very strict again, isn't it? You know, you have to notice the, you know, the
they're frozen. You know, get up and walk around, go for a run, get on a rebounder, get the whole body moved. Seriously, and I don't just say that as kind of a joke. I get people up and I get them shaking. I get them moving. I get them, going back to sitting down and seeing that if we really want to truly relax in the body, then as we sit and balance in our upright sitting posture, as we breathe in, as we breathe out, every single joint in the body can move, can respond to the transmitted motion of the force of breath. Right. So the breath moves through our body just like a wave moves through a body of water, so that it constantly can stay in motion. I want to align people back to their natural motility. And we find when we do that, it's like this armoring that we've been caught in our body and mind, it just comes wide open, and we get back into that birthright place that all of us have access to. We just have to take it.
You mentioned in the book also, you know, music is a way to do that. And I think that, talk about short circuits in the brain, you know, and getting straight into the heart, into the feeling, the felt presence of the body, you know, music does it, doesn't it? You know, there's a huge, you know, resurgence of that, you know, people like Krishna Das, you know, filling churches full of folks who want to come and listen to the kirtans or whatever. And everybody's singing kirtans these days. You know, when I did it back in the 70s, it was kind of unusual. And now it's, you know, like you say, it's like yoga on every corner. So, but I think people want to connect in that way. And it doesn't have to be Eastern, right? We beautiful music is beautiful music from whatever tradition, right? And you have a lovely story. I don't think we got time, but you were learning the Veena at one point, right? And that unusual. We're all familiar with the sitar, I think, but it's the Veena's that huge thing with the gourds and everything. But you know. It's a discipline. It's a huge discipline, but then it's letting go into that, the ecstasy of that music, right?
And you learn
your scales. That's a metaphor too.
Yeah. You learn your scales and let go. That's still the quality of music that I play. I don't play the Veena. I play guitar in a very open tuning, like a North Indian tuning, so I can go in and out of the scales. And as my music teacher taught me, you learn your scales, get a rhythm going, and then you just let go. Well, that sounds like Shiva's practice to me.
And you know, for me, it's the you know, the conundrum of life. You know, I love what Jesus said. He says, you know, be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. And you know, to me, that's the embrace. You know, you have to have a certain wisdom, a certain dedication, discipline, whatnot, but then also a freedom. You know, like the innocence of the doves, and marry those two together. You know, nobody's fool. Right. But also, but not, you know, distrustful either, you know, have that innocence, that harmlessness again, that's delightful. And you know, it's when you can balance those together, I think, you know, you have a joyous life, you know, have a free, open. I like the idea of wide open, right? You know, we're wide open. We're in the spaciousness of what the universe truly is.
I really enjoy talking to you, and you know, the things that you say, I resonate so deeply with.
Yeah, well, good. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Will. And actually, Will can give us his contacts and everything. Next week, Texas Christian University professors Mark Dennis and Andy Ford join me. They've been on the show many times before. They're going to discuss the burgeoning contemplative studies movement, both in universities throughout the U.S. and in the spiritual world in general. I think they offer spiritual practices that allow for a deepening of approach without the dogma, taking spiritual but not religious into the next phase, if you like, which is what, you know, we've been talking about today also. So join me then. But, Will, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
The easiest way is through my website, www.embodiment.net, embodiment.net. It's very easy to make connection with me through that site.
And then your books, of course, are available through all the usual outlets, I presume. Yeah. So that, yeah, if you want to get hold of this one, it's just come out. It's by the Inner Traditions Press, which is a great press out of Vermont, I think. And yep. So one word that you could leave with our listeners, what would it be?
Let go. That's two words.
Relax. You're allowed to have two.
Just falls, let go. But just let go. Know that it's okay. What you feel is okay. Let go to it.
All right. Very good. All right. Thanks for listening, folks. Thank you so much, Will. It's been a joy.
Take care.
We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.